Shalessen Abraham Appellant Counsel, Elizabeth Kiernan Fitzgerald, Assistant Attorney General at Appellate Counsel.
Well, it's easy to do here. Is this your first time on the side?
You may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, my name is Shalab Ben Abraham from the Arlington Public Defender's Office by way of the Fairfax County Public Defender's Office, and I represent Ms. Silva, the appellant in this case. Your Honor, may I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Did you say three?
3 minutes, Your Honor, yes. Your Honor, we're asking the court to overturn her probation violation conviction. There's a couple grounds for that. The first is that the trial court in February, March of 2015 did not have jurisdiction over her anymore, subject matter jurisdiction, to find her in violation of probation. The Court of Appeals erred in this case for a couple of reasons. First, they assume that a void order can be used to interpret a valid order, which is problematic.
Was January 2010 a valid order?
January of 2010 was a valid order, Your Honor.
Okay, hold up right there, because that's a big, that's a Rubicon moment for me. If it's a valid order, they can, a judge can do anything in a valid order within the boundaries of the law, including do something that was done earlier, but was done earlier wrong. So the Court of Appeals jumped on that, and I'm struggling to understand why that's not the end of the case.
Well, I respectfully disagree with you that they can do something that they couldn't do before. If the court lacked the jurisdiction...
Why not? If it had jurisdiction in January to do something it didn't have jurisdiction a year ago, so what? They didn't have jurisdiction a year ago. They did at the time they did it.
Because that's not what they actually did in the order in 2010. The order in 2010 does not specifically say that probation is being extended indefinitely. The order in 2010 specifically says that she is to remain on the same terms and conditions as previously imposed. And what the Court of Appeals did is said, well, that must be the void order, because we're going to assume that that, for purpose of this, we're going to assume that order is void from September of 2009. And that's the one that makes her on indefinite probation. So what they say is that indefinite probation from 2009, that void order, we're going to use to interpret the 2010 order, which says to remain on the same terms and conditions of probation. Well, I agree with the court. The 2010 order can say she can remain on the same terms and conditions of probation, but that has to relate back to the only other valid order, which was her initial final sentencing in 2008, which only put her on probation for 1 year, which ended.
Let me give you an example. A judge in a civil case issues a demur ruling, and he's wrong or she's wrong because there wasn't enough allegations. And later at trial, the judge issues exactly the same conclusion after hearing the evidence. It's a completely different situation. The court now has authority to do what it wants to do, what it prematurely did earlier. We would never say, I don't think, well, that later decision's wrong, even though you had the authority to do it, because you were thinking about, referring to, and even reinforcing the earlier mistaken order.
Well, Your Honor, if a court acts without subject matter jurisdiction, in which they did, and I think even the Court of Appeals, by saying it's assuming that, recognizes that the September 2009 order is in fact done without subject matter jurisdiction to extend probation.
I seriously doubt that. That they actually assumed without deciding, but actually decided it was without subject matter jurisdiction.
My understanding, they put it in the footnote, Your Honor, that we are going to assume that for purposes of this, that order is void, but it doesn't. Essentially, they say it doesn't matter, which is how they avoid dealing with the Wilson issue in this case, which is the Court of Appeals, a different panel, on the exact same issue, in a published opinion, said that the court was without jurisdiction. So the panel that
I... What's wrong with that? They have a completely different scenario where they have a later valid order doing the same thing. Why wouldn't they go to the narrowest and best? Why would they have to decide all these hypothetical issues that are not before them?
Well, Your Honor, because we're going back to the key point here is that they are taking in a order that is void ab initio to interpret what another order says. That order from 2010 does not say that probation is now extended indefinitely. That order, the final order from 2010, which is a valid order because it was done through the process of a probation revocation, says that she is to remain on the same terms and conditions as previously imposed. But if the 2009 order doesn't exist, then you have to go back to the only other order that does exist, which is the 2008 final order. And the 2008 final order...
How could it not have subject matter jurisdiction in a revocation case? Why is this nothing but an active jurisdiction issue, which has nothing to do with subject matter jurisdiction and doesn't trigger void ab initio remedies? It's just a revocation case where a revocation decision was made with the consent of the defendant, with the consent of the probation officer, consent of the court. I mean, it happens, particularly in some jurisdictions. Everyone's on board. And we're saying, no, you have no power to even do that. Now, it was a mistake. You're supposed to have a hearing. But they didn't. And we're going to say there's no subject matter jurisdiction. It doesn't exist in the eyes of the law.
Yes, Your Honor. And the reason for that is that, again, the 2009 order is based on a different code section that gives the subject matter jurisdiction to the court, and that's 192.304. And 192.304 is different than 192.306. 192.306 has a one-year time limitation in it that says if you commit a violation of probation during your probationary period, the court has 1 year after probation ends to bring process. 192.304 does not have that. 192.304, though, does allow you to change conditions of probation, extend conditions of probation, revoke probation, modify it. But there's no time limit because you can't change, modify, extend, decrease, whatever the terminology you want to use, something that no longer exists. And that's why 192.304 has implicit in it that you have to use that within the time period that you're on probation. So there's two areas on August 14th of 2009. There's two areas where the trial court has subject matter jurisdiction over Ms. Silva. It has subject matter jurisdiction on that date of her probationary period, and it has subject matter jurisdiction over her of a potential probation revocation. On 2015 of 2009, it lost subject matter jurisdiction over the probationary period, but retained it over the probation revocation, which is why we're not contending that the 2010 order is a valid conviction for her. The problem is the 2010 order does not say, I find you in violation, I impose the remainder of the jail, I resuspend it, and I put you on probation for 2 years, or I put you on indefinite probation for 2 years, which would have nullified my argument, because at that point, she would have been on probation.
Let me ask you a question, if I could. Did the court have the authority to extend probation in 2009 when that order was entered?
In the 2009 September...
As a consequence of a revocation?
Yes, it did.
Are there magic words that the court has to use? Is that your contention? They have to use magic words such as, I find you in violation of probation, I impose the sentence, I suspend it, and then put you on probation.
Well, this goes to the Jacobs case, Your Honor, which says that when you find someone in violation of probation, it automatically revokes all the remaining suspended time. And in Jacobs, there wasn't those magic words used, but ultimately what the court found is that by resuspending a period of time or saying, I'm imposing 6 months, the remainder of it is suspended. And the reason for that is we don't nullify the original sentence, because what the appellant in Jacobs was trying to argue was when the court said, I'm only giving back 6 months, it nullified the remaining years when a second and subsequent probation violation came around. The court said, you can't do that. The final order still stays in place. And that's what we have here. And in fact, Ms. Silva had another probation case that went through the Court of Appeals that a panel held basically on those grounds. There was a case where she was given 2 years with 3 years for 3 years suspended and then probation for 2 years. Well, that initial order at a subsequent probation violation was never changed. So when her three-year period of the suspension of the sentence ran in 2015, which was over in 2013, the court did not have jurisdiction. So a panel of the Court of Appeals in that case found that there was no more jurisdiction for the trial court because the initial probation order, or revocation order that was filed and finalized by the court, did not specifically address the period for which the sentence had originally been suspended. When we boil it all down, there are different concepts within probation. There's obviously the good behavior period, there's the suspended sentence and for how long that is suspended for, and then there's probation. What we come down to is this, though. The Court of Appeals used a void order, the 2009 order, which extended her probation indefinitely, did not specifically in the 2010 order say, I'm extending probation indefinitely, you are now on probation indefinitely. That order says to remain on all the same terms and conditions as previously imposed. Well, if that order doesn't exist, then you have to go back to the next valid order. And the next valid order was the original final sentence from 2008, which ended her probation. So what do we have?
In a single sentence, why is the September 2009 order void ab initio? And with a single sentence and a single cite, can you do that?
Yes, Your Honor. It's void because the court did not have jurisdiction to extend her probation under 304.
Subject matter jurisdiction?
Subject matter jurisdiction.
Active jurisdiction?
Both, Your Honor, under 304.
Well, it's a huge difference because active jurisdiction is waivable. Active jurisdiction violations cannot be collaterally attacked. And it doesn't render anything void ab initio. It's a gigantic distinction that Wilson actually missed.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's subject matter jurisdiction that the court lacks
subject... What's your best cite for that?
My best cite for that is Wilson. Wilson said that it's subject matter jurisdiction.
Suppose Wilson's wrong.
Well, obviously that's why it's in front of this court. But that gets to a different point as to why, if the court here does think Wilson is wrong, what it really should do is send this back to the Court of Appeals, because there should have been an en banc hearing, because the Court of Appeals violated the interpanel accord doctrine. Wilson was a published decision.
We don't have to abide by anything that the Court of any of the Court of Appeals rules. If Wilson is wrong, we can overrule it.
That is correct, Your Honor. I fully understand that. I'm just pointing out that when you have all of these different probation violation issues coming up, the Court of Appeals, when they have a published opinion on Wilson, this panel specifically went around Wilson
to
come up with this.
I have to interrupt again. I'm sorry to push back on this, but this panel didn't do that. This panel, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, said we don't need to go into a cage match with Wilson because the later 2010 order makes it irrelevant, right? Why is that a nefarious going around something? Why isn't that actually prudence by a court?
To answer your question, Your Honor, because what they do then is they say the 2009 order you're complaining of is what we're going to use to interpret the 2010 order. So if a 2009 order, so they don't address whether the 2009 order is valid or void or whatnot, but they're now going to use it.
Let me ask you a question to get back to what Justice Millett asked about magic words. There were conditions imposed in the 2009 order. The 2010 order referred back to those conditions, incorporating them into the 2010 order. Even if the 2009 order, the order itself was invalid, why couldn't the 2010 incorporate the language from that order, which was present in the file?
Well, to answer the question to that, Your Honor, is because the 2009 order should never be in the file, number one. But number two, the 2010 order, if you look at it specifically, does not reference the September 2009 order. It just says what previously conditions are imposed. So if those
that's sort of the magic word, or I'm adopting the magic word argument from Justice Millett. If there is a paper out there that has no force and effect, but it has words in it, why can't a valid document incorporate those words?
I think it could, Your Honor, if the order specifically says, what I mean is I want you to look at the September 16th, 2009 order when I say previous terms and conditions, because then that does validate in 2010 that this is what I mean, this is what I want you to interpret from. So to answer your question, it could, but in this case it doesn't. In this case, it doesn't reference the 2009, it just says same terms and conditions, which must refer back to the 2008 order, which is the final valid order that's in this case. And I see that I went over the three-minute part. I'd like to just reserve the rest of my time at this point for rebuttal.
147.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Elizabeth Fitzgerald on behalf of the Commonwealth. The defendant was on indefinite supervised probation when she committed the offenses that led to her fourth revocation proceeding in this case in 2015. As the Court of Appeals correctly held, regardless of the validity of the 2009 order, the 2010 revocation order provided freestanding support for the trial court's authority to revoke the defendant's supervised probation in 2015. Moreover, the trial court had subject matter jurisdiction over the defendant's felony conviction throughout these proceedings, so neither the 2009 nor the 2010 order can be collaterally attacked at this time.
May I interrupt for a second? If I misunderstood your colleague's point in response to Justice Powell and Justice Millett, if the 2010 order had expressly referenced the 2009 order, then we wouldn't be here. Did I hear that right?
Your Honor, I drew the same conclusion, and I would point the court to the language of that order itself, which is at appendix page 31. The trial court does expressly reference that prior
order. At the very top of the page, on September 16, 2009, the court ordered that, and it describes it verbatim. So if magic words were required, it sounds like we have them.
Yes, Your Honor, and the court would not need to look further than the four corners of this final order in 2010. The trial court recites that in September 16th of 2009, and I'm reading from the top of appendix page 31, the court ordered that the defendant's period of supervised probation be extended indefinitely in order for the defendant to complete residential drug treatment and aftercare time for disposition of her pending charges. The trial court then finds that she's in violation of the terms of that suspended sentence, elects not to impose an additional jail time, but instead decides to continue her on or remain under the same terms and conditions of supervised probation. The only logical interpretation of that language is that the court is referring to the September 16th, 2009 order, which it references two paragraphs above.
Can I ask you a question about one of the things opposing counsel said? He said that this was the 2009 order was a 19-2304 order as opposed to a 19-2306 order. And I have a question about that. It seems like when the 2009 order was entered, it was entered based upon a revocation that was pending. And the parties just sort of short-circuited it and then entered this order. Didn't the court have the authority to extend probation as part of a revocation disposition?
Certainly, Your Honor, the court had the authority to extend as part of a revocation proceeding. My understanding from the record, and again, it's difficult because, you know, we're looking at proceedings in 2009, 2010. We don't have a complete record here. But my understanding is that the court issued a bench warrant that was never served. And that warrant and then the subsequent order were entered, and the court recalled the bench warrant. So there was not actually, in my reading of the record, a finding that she was in violation in terms and conditions of her probation.
And that's sort of the magic words I was talking about. Does the court have to use those magic words in order to make this a revocation under 19-2306 or an order entered under 19.2-306?
It is an interesting question, Your Honor, but in this case, because we're talking about a collateral attack on, you know, on a presumptively valid judgment, it wouldn't make a difference in this case because an error under either of those code sections wouldn't make...
I agree with you about that, but it may be a valid order altogether. The Court of Appeals never even addressed whether it was a valid order.
Certainly, Your Honor, and the trial court, of course, in this case, in 2015, in construing these orders, assumed without deciding and made it very clear that, you know, I'm not saying that initial order by the Fairfax District Court by Judge Ney was void, so the court just, or rather was in error, given the particular procedural posture there. Certainly the court had the potential.
Wasn't it really in the nature of as Justice Millett is implying, in the nature of a settlement? I mean, you issue a CAPIUS on a Condition 1 violation, happens 1,000 times a week, and the probation officer comes to you and says, we've worked this out. We're going to help this lady get back on track. We don't need a hearing. We don't need a bunch of witnesses. We're all in agreement. What would a trial judge do, exercising his authority under 306, other than, well, good, I hope it all works out. What do you want me to sign? What's wrong with that, much less how could whatever is wrong with that be a violation of subject matter jurisdiction?
Certainly, Your Honor, and if we were here as an original matter on that 2009, you know, if we were on direct appeal in 2009 from the entry of that court's order, I think that's certainly an argument that the Commonwealth could make with regard to Your Honor's point about magic words. If the court did have the statutory authority to revoke her at that time, it did have authority over her revocation proceedings, and in fact, it did alter those terms. You know, whether we're really looking at a 306 or 304 issue, it could be a live issue, certainly, but you know, whether that order, so now we're talking about not only is that order not voidable, or not void, rather, but also not voidable. So certainly getting back to the issue that brings us here today, reference to that 2009 order is not problematic in this context, and in fact, this court could simply hold that the 2009 order was perfectly valid and, you know, short-circuit the other analysis the Court of Appeals chose to go with the 2010 order and say we're not going to get into the subject matter jurisdiction issue. This court could say there was subject matter jurisdiction all along. There's no problem here. So under either kind of those branching arguments, the trial court's final revocation proceeding here should be affirmed.
Help me out with this idea that I think you said there can't be a collateral attack on the 2009 order. Did I hear that right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Tell me why.
Because that order was entered by the trial court when it had subject matter jurisdiction over the defendant's felony case. The revocation proceedings were part of a purely criminal process that arises from her felony conviction. As this court has held in Porter, all circuit courts in the Commonwealth have subject matter jurisdiction or potential jurisdiction over felonies committed in the Commonwealth, and that would certainly include Silva's felony grand larceny conviction, the initial conviction in this case. Because the trial court in 2009 still had subject matter jurisdiction over her felony case, certainly.
Wouldn't it be more accurate to say, rather than that they can't collaterally attack the order, the basis for it is simply wrong?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, we've always said if an order is void ab initio, you can challenge it anywhere, anytime. It's almost without limitation.
Yes.
And I thought that's what you were saying.
Oh, I apologize.
You can't do that. But I think you can do that.
Certainly you can. It's just that it would not be successful in this case.
That's right. So what your point is that perhaps they could try to do that, but they would be without question wrong.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Which makes the 2009 order, if you have to do this, fair game for incorporating language.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, well, now I get it.
I apologize for not being precise.
No, that's all right. It would only be your first defense in 15 years.
I appreciate that. And so, again, looking at that 2009 order, as the court has pointed out, certainly even if this were a void order and we're contending it's not, the court is referencing a historical document. It exists in the file the same way that we're referencing and arguing about it today. Just because it has no legal effect doesn't mean that that piece of paper doesn't exist and the trial court can't look back at that piece of paper and do what he has authority to do and bring that indefinite term of supervised probation forward. And that is exactly what happened in this case, looking at just the body of the 2010 order. There was nothing wrong with doing that, and the Court of Appeals was certainly correct in reaching that conclusion. We would ask this court, however, to go beyond that and find that there was subject matter jurisdiction in 2009, and that is in particularly to clarify the state of the law with regards to the Wilson case. That's a published opinion in the Court of Appeals. Certainly any opinion of this court that the trial court did have subject matter jurisdiction in 2009 would implicitly overrule Wilson. And to the extent that that case law is out there, this court should take the opportunity to go beyond the Court of Appeals order and clarify the state of the law in that regard. We've seen a number of these revocation cases. The court had a revocation case this morning and also this afternoon. There's a large body of law on revocation proceedings in the Court of Appeals. And so it would be beneficial to practitioners for the court to weigh in this area. But again, of course, the court does not have to, as the Court of Appeals did. And I'm sure you're well aware of that.
That's a relief.
You can take the rest of the day off. I would be happy to answer questions that the court has regarding the application of contract law. In this case, I know it wasn't addressed by my opposing counsel here, but if the court has no questions there, I would rest on my brief, and I would ask you to affirm.
All right. Rebuttal?
Your Honors, in the brief time I have, there's a couple things I want to clear up that came up on the Commonwealth's argument. The first is that the January 28th, 2010 order does not order that the 2009 order incorporate into it. And specifically, you can see where the order, if you read it into the app 31, it says it lists the history of the case. And then there's in bold and black ordering language. And the main ordering language is ultimately the court further ordered that the defendant remain under the same terms and conditions of supervised probation.
Can I interrupt you for a second?
The yes,
top
sir.
Paragraph, 2009 order did X.
I understand that, Your Honor.
Yeah, hold up. And the X is extend indefinitely. And then two paragraphs down, the court orders that the defendant remain under the same terms and conditions of supervised probation. What possibly could they be referring to if it were not for the 2009 order?
Your Honor, they're referring to the 2008 order, which is the only valid order that's left.
Even though
the 2009 order.
They mentioned the 2009 order.
I understand that it mentions the 2009 order, but the 2009 order is void, Your Honor. And so, therefore, it has to be making reference to the 2008 order.
The court in 2010, even if you're right, and I'm not conceding that, the court in 2010 did not know that the 2009 order was void.
That's correct. I mean,
if you just look at the language of the 2010 order and you say, what was the judge intending? It strains credulity to say, well, he was intending to go back to 2008 because he thought maybe in 2019 we would find that order void.
And I see that my time is up. Can I answer that question? Because I do think it's important.
Can I answer a question that's pending?
Yes, Your Honor. So, Your Honor, I agree that I believe that Judge Ney was intending exactly what you said. But the legal operation of the law doesn't necessarily work as he was intending. The court has to go through what he actually writes and what is actually valid. And what is actually valid is the 2009 order is not valid. Therefore, it has to go back to the 2008 order. And I just want to be really clear about this whole thing. The Commonwealth, and if the argument being presented is that what's above the ordered language should be incorporated and included, then if you look at the 2009 order, above the final operation of that order, the one from September, it specifically says that the purpose of it is to follow through on certain conditions. Those conditions in the record were met prior to this happening. And since it's an agreement, if the court is going down that road, then, in fact, Ms. Silva satisfied those agreements. It was a contract subsequent, and she should have been off probation. So I would ask the court to reverse.
The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All rise.